People should continue to practice good hygiene, and wash your hands, avoid touching your face, and wear a mask wherever it's indicated, or wherever you're not able to practice social distancing.
That is Vice President Mike Pence last week after months of denying the necessity of wearing a mask to protect himself and others against COVID-19. After all, the pandemic is rising fast all over the country.
We are now having 40-plus thousand new cases a day. I would not be surprised if we go up to 100,000 a day if this does not turn around. And so I am very concerned.
But despite the growing number of cases and despite the science, resistance to wearing a mask is still going strong.
Hey, I'm not going to wear a face diaper.
I have a breathing problem. My doctor would not let me wear a mask. You guys are violating federal law. Do you get that?
And I'm not doing it because I woke up in a free country.
This is a false flag.
Excuse me, sir.
Pandemic. You are in violation of my constitutional rights. You're terrorists. There's no pandemic.
I don't care. It's still not legal. Just because everybody's doing it doesn't make it legal. Texas governor said it's not legal and I don't have to.
I'm sorry that you don't like it, but I mean, I don't like wearing a mask.
Well, I'm going to ask you to come over here.
Every single one of you have a smirk behind that little mask, but every single one of you are going to get punished by God.
But Vice President Pence is not the only Republican who's ready to buck that backlash. Here's the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell.
Wearing simple face coverings is not about protecting ourselves. It is about protecting everyone we encounter.
And here's the House Republican Leader, Kevin McCarthy.
Every American has a responsibility. They should wear a mask.
President Trump, of course, is still proudly going without a mask and planning more indoor rallies between now and Election Day. So Democrat Joe Biden is happy to join those other Republicans who are going the other way.
Everyone needs to wear a mask in public. Period. Wear a mask. It may be inconvenient. It may be uncomfortable. But it's the right thing to do as an American.
As COVID-19 cases skyrocket in the Sunbelt states, Trump's handling of the pandemic may be costly to him and to the GOP.
Putting in play big prizes across the Sunbelt that had previously seemed completely out of reach for Democrats.
That's Ron Brownstein of The Atlantic and CNN. We'll hear more from him later. But first, a major question that still remains. Why do so many Americans refuse to wear masks when there's concrete evidence that they're defying their own interests? We have two guests to help answer that question. Katherine Sanderson is life science professor at Amherst College, author of Why We Act, Turning Bystanders into Moral Rebels. Clay Jenkinson is editor-at-large of the national magazine Governing. He's host of the podcast The Thomas Jefferson Hour, and author most recently of Repairing Jefferson's America, A Guide to Civility and Enlightened Leadership. I want to welcome you both to our program, and Clay Jenkinson, we're going to start with you. It's often said that the motto of our country is "Don't tread on me." Is that what this is all about?
Yes, it's partly about that. It's partly about public ignorance. You know, Thomas Jefferson said, if you expect to be a nation ignorant and free, you expect something that never has been and never can be in a state of civilization. Well, we're testing that right now. And there are millions of Americans who will resist doing the right thing for themselves and their neighbors just because they have an attitude that government or no outside entity, including experts, should ever tell them what to do. And of course, it doesn't help that the President of the United States is the chief rebel. If he were modeling thoughtful, scientifically based public health behavior by wearing a mask and talking about these precautions, millions of people would comply, maybe reluctantly. But when they have a cheerleader who says, oh, just go for it, do whatever you want, it'll go away, those people become empowered, and their ignorance then becomes a public health threat to the rest of us.
Well, you've written now about Thomas Jefferson. You have a podcast called The Thomas Jefferson Hour. Wasn't he in favor of as little government as possible? Didn't "don't tread on me" sound good to him?
Yes, I think that we should voluntarily comply with these public health standards. I'm not necessarily saying we should have thought police or mask police out there in every situation. Jefferson believed that that government is best which governs least. But intelligent people know, without a doubt, that social distancing and mask wearing are the number one way to prevent the rapid spread of this disease. I mean, there's really no fundamental debate about that, unless you want to talk about herd immunity and just let things play out as they will. But we know this from the Spanish flu epidemic in 1918. We know this from the yellow fever epidemic in 1793. The only perennial methods of preventing the rapid spread of infectious diseases are to keep away from each other and to cover our mouths, and masks are a perfect way to do that. So you don't need government to enforce that. You just need good sense.
So, and yet we resist, or many of us do. Professor Sanderson, let me turn to you. How does the issue of mask wearing become a question of liberty and losing your liberty?
So it's a fascinating question, and I am recording this interview, of course, from Massachusetts, where mask wearing is very, very normal, that everyone does it, it's expected, and it would be, in fact, highly unusual if somebody was not. And yet it's certainly clear that there are parts of the country in which it's a much less common behavior, as we've all seen. And I think the challenge, exactly as Clay points out, is it becomes one of social norms. What are other people around us doing? I would feel highly uncomfortable walking into my grocery store not wearing a mask because everyone around me is doing so. But in certain parts of the country, you see the exact opposite, where most people are not wearing a mask, and it becomes very difficult, in fact, for someone to dare to do so.
Is this really regional? Is it so universally accepted in Massachusetts as opposed to California, for example, upstate New York, Michigan, where a guard at a business was killed because the business insisted that a customer wear a mask?
So I imagine it's both regional and also very specific. So, of course, I'm recording from Western Massachusetts, a pretty liberal part of Massachusetts in general. And Massachusetts, of course, is one of the most liberal states. But we've certainly seen reports from Texas, from Arizona, from Florida, in which mask wearing is not normative. We heard the example of the Republican National Convention moved from North Carolina to Jacksonville, Florida, specifically because at the time, North Carolina was strongly insisting, their governor, that mask wearing would in fact happen, and that was seen as undesirable. Whereas in Florida, there were in fact different laws about wearing a mask. Ironically, of course, there's some data suggesting that now Jacksonville is requiring mask wearing, and so that strategy of moving the convention may in fact have backfired.
Let me go back to Clay Jenkinson. Do you see this as, in part at least, regional?
Yes, it's blue v. red. So even in Massachusetts, there are pockets of red culture that would resist this. But I can give you an anecdote from yesterday. I flew back from Portland, Oregon to North Dakota, to Bismarck. And in the Portland International Airport, 90% or more people wore masks. In Denver, where I had a layover, about 80% of the people wore masks. But the other 20% looked kind of defiant and angry. And when I got to Bismarck International Airport, about 3% wore masks, and they were being sneered at by those who regard this as a hoax, who believe that masks are really just a way of saying you're a Democrat or a liberal, and that they have very little to do with public health whatsoever. And so that's the state of things. We've allowed ourselves to weaponize even public health measures on really silly partisan lines. It's deplorable. And it would be one thing if this were just attitudes, but this affects my health. You know, people don't understand that wearing a mask is not primarily about you or me. It's about everybody else. We wear a mask to protect the people around us from the virus. It also protects ourselves, but it's an act of courtesy and respect to the Commonwealth rather than just something for my own health. I think a lot of people out here think that's not going to happen to me. I'm healthy. That's just that's something that happens to weak people. And therefore, they forget that the mask is not fundamentally about themselves.
Well, I love your story about the airports. Portland, 90%. Denver, 80%. Bismarck, 20%. Catherine Sanderson, does that suggest to you that the people in those different places are looking at each other and getting different signals from the people that are surrounding them?
Absolutely. And I think that really speaks to the power, again, of social norms. And as Clay noted earlier, if we had a president saying, everyone should wear a mask. It's very normal. We would actually probably see a rise in mask wearing, particularly in the red states. I see some evidence already that we're maybe moving in that direction. As Clay noted, Vice President Mike Pence is now wearing a mask, which he was defiantly not doing earlier. I believe Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has actually now tweeted about the importance of everyone wearing a mask. But again, social norms are formed based on leaders, and different people may be looking to leaders in different way. For some people, it might be the governor of their state. For some people, it might be a sports hero. For other people, it might be, of course, President Trump.
Interestingly enough, Senator McConnell says face coverings when he suggests that people ought to be protecting themselves. He doesn't use the word masks. I wonder if that tells us something.
That's a fascinating insight. That sounds like another whole topic for a psychologist to study.
Okay, there's psychology and then there's history. Clay Jenkinson, are there examples of when people in the United States have gotten together and done something important, even though others, maybe a lot of people, found it inconvenient or even offensive?
Yes, of course, both in epidemiology and outside of it. So, you know, the founding fathers, the people who met in Philadelphia in the summer of 1776, got together a revolution, even though they were probably a minority. If there had been a plebiscite in 1776, I doubt that the whole mass of the American people would have voted for independence. And then you think of something like the Spanish flu epidemic in 1918. After the first wave, a lot of people gave up on social distancing and thought it was over. But when it came screaming back, and the second wave was almost infinitely worse than the first, some states like California had mandatory mask wearing, and they enforced it very rigorously because they didn't have what we have, which are vaccines and ameliorative drugs coming probably before Valentine's Day, maybe even before Christmas. And so they were victims of pandemics in a way that we don't have to be. We understand more than they did. We have better public health measures, theoretically, and we also will develop vaccines. And so there have been moments where communities come together, but the social fabric of the United States has been eroding for a long, long time, certainly since the Reagan Revolution in 1980. And that, coupled with the sort of general don't tread on me spirit of the American people, particularly people in red states, has created a massive public health problem. I take it very personally. My daughter is a student at Oxford University. She's now living in my basement here in North Dakota. She probably can't get back to London because the Europeans are going to close their airports to us because we're doing so badly at this.
Professor Sanderson, you talked about the regional nature of this, and you've both indicated that this has to do with the culture wars. But are there basic psychological factors that help to explain why people resist wearing masks?
So I think that people do have a tendency in general to see themselves as not so vulnerable. I think we've all seen examples in which within red states or blue states, young people going to bars, ignoring the evident risk. And that's the same kind of risky behavior that we see with college students engaging in binge drinking or other kinds of risky, less healthy behaviors. We tend to see men showing riskier behaviors than women. And early reports are suggesting already that across the country, women are more likely to be wearing masks than are men. Now, maybe that relates to Clay's point in that women may be more focused on altruistic behaviors, protecting other people, whereas men may be more focused on, yeah, I'm strong, I'm masculine, I don't have to worry about getting sick. So we also see differences across both age and gender.
Clay Jenkinson, you and I are men. Do you feel that it is somehow destroying your masculinity if you put on a mask?
No, but I'm probably not typical in that respect. Real men don't eat quiche. Real men don't wear masks. You know, it's interesting that the countries that are handling this best in the world are those that are ruled by women. Angela Merkel, New Zealand, Germany. You know, women, I think, are less caught up in a kind of a macho self-identity, a kind of resistance to anything that they didn't think of themselves. And I think women have a, at least as they're culturally constructed, have a greater interest in the wider community than just themselves and their immediate family. And so, you know, Boris Johnson and Donald Trump are doing quite badly in all of this. Angela Merkel has done so well that Germany has been able to reopen quite successfully, and New Zealand is the class act of the world. If you just look at that from a gender point of view, it doesn't look good for you and me, Warren.
I'm afraid that's the case. Professor Sanderson, what about the media and the notion of balancing stories and giving credibility to both sides of an issue? Do you think that has been that has contributed to the mixed messaging that has, I think, confused a lot of people about this?
I do, and I think it's really been very harmful, because this is a clear case, as Clay noted earlier, in which the science is irrefutable, that it's very, very clear that during this time, wearing a mask dramatically reduces the transmission, and it's very clear that the transmission is causing disruption in all of our lives and causing children not to be able to go to school, businesses to close, you know, the airline industry to be in trouble, and so on. So we all are actually going to benefit if people wear masks and the virus doesn't spread and things can kind of get back to normal. Maybe a normal in which we're wearing masks, maybe a normal in which we're doing some social distancing, but certainly a normal in which some of the things that we all enjoy can happen. But when the media presents it as, well, there's evidence for a mask and evidence against a mask, that's just not really scientifically accurate.
Well, Professor Sanderson, I want to rescue my gender. My producer, who is a woman, reminds me that a lot of women have been very loudly protesting the wearing of masks in Orange County, California. Angry, adamant women were part of the reason Dr. Nicole Quick, the public health administrator, quit her job. So is the resistance all gender-based? Is there a tipping point of some kind where women go the other way?
So I think that it's clear that there are men who are wearing masks. We've seen, you know, early on in the pandemic, Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York was actually really seen as the leader in terms of trying to handle what was a massive problem in New York City in particular. And so we've all seen examples of men, in fact, being absolute leaders on this front. And as you just noted, a woman really not doing the right thing and needing to step down. So it's not as simple as male or female. It's probably not as simple as red state or blue state. But what I think is most important is that if in a given community you reach a tipping point of maybe 25% of people doing the behavior, as long as they're the right 25% of people, people who are role models, people who have social capital in a sense, you can actually sway a community. And as we start thinking about letting college students return to classes, letting high school students go back and so on, it's going to be extraordinarily important for people to make sure that the norms and the models in particular environment are of wearing a mask and being safe, because that will encourage other people in a given group or community to do the same.
Clay Jenkinson, an interesting political example that I know you've referred to from history has to do with President Herbert Hoover and his successor, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and the different ways that they approached the massive threat that came from the Depression. Talk a little bit about that and how it's analogous to what's happening now.
Yes, first of all, I want to say that I agree so much with Catherine Sanderson's point that a critical mass can be reached. So if 5% are wearing masks, that gives everyone cover who doesn't wish to. If 25% are wearing masks, harder to resist. If 60% are wearing masks, then you feel you almost have to get on board. And I think we need to see people taking that leadership role. You know, Herbert Hoover said, let's just ride this thing out. He's a laissez-faire capitalist. Things will get better. You know, Adam Smith was right. The less government tampers with the economy, the better. Not only was he wrong, but he was repudiated in an extraordinary way by the American people who elected Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who then went on to win three subsequent elections, serving almost four terms as president, unprecedented. I think we should all learn a lesson from that. And I will say this, I hope that this isn't too political, but I think that President Trump is committing an act of self-destruction in the way that he's handling this. The American people may not be highly educated about these things, but they do have common sense. And the common sense is telling them that, you know, Pence is probably right, President Trump is probably wrong. I think that the way the president has handled this is almost an exact analogy to Herbert Hoover in 1929, 1930, and 1931. And I think the polls are showing this, that the American people, they kind of are rooting for Trump in some ways, some of them. I think they think, well, wait a minute, in a moment like this, you want actual leadership. You want adults in the room. And this guy is sort of behaving like a bully and an adolescent when in our hearts we know we really do need to take the responsible social steps. And so I think that he's probably costing himself, or he certainly could be costing himself re-election by not stepping up and behaving like a true leader here.
Professor Sanderson, I'm very interested in what you said about what it takes to sway a community, I think was the phrase that you used, and whether the right 20% do the right thing and people then go in a different direction, or I suppose the wrong thing can also happen. But we've been so quick, it seems to me, to recognize same-sex marriage, to recognize LGBTQ. All of a sudden, those things have become acceptable. And now Black Lives Matter, which very recently, it seems to me, was not on the front burner. White people all over the country are parading around in the streets and taking risks in their communities on behalf of Black Lives Matter. Do you think there's a possibility that we'll reach the tipping point when it comes to wearing masks and trying to deal effectively with the coronavirus?
Absolutely. And I love the examples that you give, because I think those are such vivid illustrations of how things that seem impossible to imagine all of a sudden can actually quickly become the new normal. When I was a college student, if you had told me the Supreme Court would legalize gay marriage and we would have a viable presidential candidate who was a gay man, I would have thought there was no possibility. We've seen just within the last month, really, the New York Times has reported how support for the Black Lives Matter movement has increased substantially in really just a matter of weeks. And that's an example about how we can reach a tipping point and all of a sudden things become very different. In April, I ordered 5 masks for my 5 members of my family on Etsy. If you had told me 6 months ago I would be placing an order for masks on Etsy, I would have said, there's no scenario by which I will do that. And this is an example about how things are going to be very different. And I think that's actually exciting. It's hopeful that there can be change in ways that are positive.
So, Clay Jenkinson, you began by talking about public ignorance in this country. Can you be optimistic about what might be happening as a result of all that we are seeing and despite the failures of President Trump and others?
Yes, I'm very optimistic. I think we're going to rise to this occasion, particularly on the question of racial justice and equality. I think we've reached a tipping point. I think we're all surprised at the volume and the intensity and the protests, that they're not stopping, that in the Senate of the United States realizes that this is bigger than normal politics. I think we're seeing something happening here, and I certainly hope it plays out into real reforms, responsible reforms, and that we rise, it's the 4th of July, as we think about this, that we rise to the level of Jefferson's great sentence, that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all human beings are created equal. You know, we haven't reached that yet. After more than 200 years, we still have work to do. I think the American people get it. I think that this is an unprecedented moment, and we might just see some real change. And I think that this is vindication of Jefferson, because he said that sometimes you can't petition, sometimes you can't write letters to the editor or op-ed pieces or contact your congressperson. Sometimes you have to raise the volume until the people of the leadership class hear you. And I think we're seeing that happen. And Jefferson, I believe, would say, I like a little rebellion now and then. It's as important in the political world as thunderstorms are in the natural world, which is what he said about Shays' rebellion in 1786. I think this is a revolutionary moment. I hope we don't duck it.
Back to the pandemic, though, do you think that in the Bismarck airport anytime soon, you're going to be seeing more than 3% of the people wearing masks?
Yes, because I think the second wave is coming. You know, we thought that we had gotten on top of this. This is, by the way, true of all pandemics. I've looked at them now from the Iliad. It opens with a pandemic and the Peloponnesian War in the 5th century BCE, and you just follow them through. We make the same mistakes every time. We're late to the game. We start with covering it up. Then we're in denial. We slowly get on board, and we always go back into the public square too quickly and worsen the problem. So we're really just behaving the way humans always behave. Apparently, we don't really learn many lessons. But I think the second wave is going to frighten people. I think it is frightening people, and they're realizing, uh-oh, this thing doesn't just go away because you want it to. And I believe you'll see a rise in the wearing of masks, including in red states, I think Dr. Anthony Fauci is giving us really extraordinary national advice, and I see people beginning to listen to it.
So, Professor Sanderson, do you agree, and do you think that enlightenment will spread from Western Massachusetts to other parts of the country?
Well, I will point out, in light of the parallel that you noted earlier, that Massachusetts was the first state to legalize gay marriage, and certainly that seemed to have swept across the rest of the country just 11 short years later. I very much agree with Clay's optimism that I think that we will see change. And I think early on it became seen as, oh, the coronavirus is only a problem in New York and Connecticut and Massachusetts and New Jersey, and many other states were sort of like, this isn't a problem. And those states really didn't take appropriate precautions, and in some cases closed down for a matter of weeks, not months. And now we can see the rising rates of the virus in Texas, Florida, Arizona. And I agree, as people start understanding the severity and its impact on those around them, I think people will really be forced to take it seriously and change their behavior.
Well, it's great to talk with both of you. I want to thank Catherine Sanderson, a professor at Amherst College, her book, Why We Act, Turning Bystanders into Moral Rebels. And Clay Jenkinson, editor-at-large, the national magazine Governing, a host of the podcast, The Thomas Jefferson Hour. His most recent book, Repairing Jefferson's America, A Guide to Civility and Enlightened Leadership. It's been great to talk to both of you, and thanks very much.
This has been wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care, both of you.
Now, of course, remember this. Fox News has been among those media outlets disparaging the wearing of masks. But listen to this from Steve Ducey, the host of Fox and Friends this past week.
But more states every day are mandating people, their citizens, to wear masks. And I think that if the president wore one, it would just set a good example. He'd be a good role model. I don't see any downside to the president wearing a mask in public. MAGA should now stand for Masks Are Great Again. Let me give you some marketing advice right there.
In a moment, Ron Brownstein on what the polls show about the influence of the coronavirus pandemic and Trump's handling of it on politics nationally and in the Sun Belt states, and also what might be in store for the Republican Party. Back in a moment with To The Point.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
All right, I'll be back with To The Point. In the Sun Belt states of the South and Southwest, the year 2020 presents a 4th of July like no other. Many beaches are closed, bars are shut down, and Republican governors are saying that wearing masks is a good idea after all. That could have a major impact on the November election and on the future of the Republican Party. That's Ron Brownstein's conclusion from reading the latest polls. He's with The Atlantic and CNN. Hi, Ron. Good to have you as always.
Hey, Warren. Good to be here.
Tell us more. How is this a threat to both President Trump and his party?
Well, if you ask me to predict, standing here in July of 2020, to two biggest stories of the decade of the 2020s politically, I would say demographically, the biggest story is the pace at which people born after 1981 replace people born before 1964 in the electorate. So basically the millennials and Generation Z replacing the boomers and the older voters. But if you said geographically, what's the most important story in American politics over the next decade? I would say it is the movement of the big metro areas across the Sun Belt in the same direction that we have seen metros outside of the Sun Belt move really over the last 25 years toward the Democrats. I mean, if we take the long view, in the 1990s, we saw the big suburban areas on the coasts, primarily California and New Jersey and Illinois in the Midwest, move toward the Democrats. In the 2000s, we saw the same kind of process in Colorado, Northern Virginia, and parts of North Carolina. And now, really, since really beginning in 2016 in earnest, we are seeing the same process beginning to unfold in the big metros of what had been previously Republican-leaning states across the Sun Belt. So it's the Atlanta metro, it's Houston and Dallas, it's Phoenix, It's San Antonio and Austin, which had already been drifting toward the Democrats. In 2016, Democrats made big gains in all of those places relative to where they had been before. In 2018, they extended them, winning House seats in all of those places, Atlanta, Houston, Dallas, one that kind of touched on the Phoenix metro. And what we are seeing in early polling for 2020 is the possibility that the continued movement of those metro areas and the widening gulf between them and the rural areas of those states are putting in play big prizes across the Sun Belt that had previously seen completely out of reach for Democrats. Arizona most immediately in 2020, but Georgia is not out of the question, and Texas is likely to be very, very close. And the key final ingredient in all of this is that the coronavirus outbreak is now literally burning through the Sun Belt. As of this morning, right before we went on, we were up to 50,000 cases in Maricopa County, which is Phoenix. It was the largest county in America that Trump won in 2016. We're up to 50,000 combined cases in Harris and Dallas counties. Harris is Houston. 30,000 more in Fort Worth, Austin, and San Antonio combined. Over 35,000 in Miami-Dade, which is another one of these metros that are moving, and over 25,000 combined in the Atlanta metro. This is kind of a perfect storm that is bringing all of these states in reach, even if Trump's rural strength may allow him to hold on narrowly to several of them.
And this is really significant because the metropolitan areas that you're talking about are, as I understand it, the focus now of growth in terms of both economy and population.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look, you know, I have said to you before, the one sentence description of Trump's electoral strategy, the trade he has fundamentally imposed on the Republican Party, is squeezing bigger margins out of shrinking groups and shrinking places at the price of provoking greater resistance in the places and in the groups that are growing. And nowhere is that more apparent than in the Sun Belt metros. In Georgia, in Texas, in Arizona, and for that matter, a little more dispersed in Florida, the biggest metro centers account routinely for 70% of the total economic activity in the state, 70% of the GDP, 70% of the jobs. Often they are 70% of the population growth, population or more. Denver is another one where you know you see the big concentration, although not quite that high. And it's the same story everywhere, right? I mean, it's the same story. I mean, what's happening in Texas now and happening in Arizona and happening in Georgia is what happened in Colorado and Virginia, for that matter, a few years ago, which is that Republicans are remaining strong and even getting stronger in the small town, exurban, and rural places. But by and large, that is not where the population growth is happening. Many of those places are stagnant or losing population. And in return, Republicans are losing ground in the big, diverse, info-age, secular, tolerant, metropolitan areas of all of these states. And, you know, the story is that what happened in Contra Costa and Santa Clara and San Mateo in the 90s and what happened in Denver and Jefferson and Arapahoe outside Denver and, Fairfax and Alexandria and Arlington, Virginia in the aughts, that is now happening in Houston and Dallas, in Atlanta, and so forth. Just one quick number to kind of give you the sense of this magnitude. You know, it was a big deal in 2012 when Obama won the five largest counties in Texas, which include the counties around Houston, Dallas, Austin, San Antonio, and Fort Worth. He won those five largest counties in Texas by a combined 130,000 votes. In 2018, Beto won those same five counties. Beto O'Rourke, the Democratic Senate candidate, won those same five counties by six times as much. 790,000 votes. And it is entirely possible that Biden could approach a million vote margin in them this year. So even if Trump squeezes out enough overwhelming support in the small town or, you know, kind of the last picture show, Texas, the trend lines are clear. Those places are not growing. The places where Republicans are losing votes, losing share, that's where the growth is.
And Dr. Fauci says that it may be that there are 100,000 cases a day as we go forward. I presume that would occur, those cases would occur in some of the very places we're talking about.
Yes, and not only did Fauci say that, that there'd be 100,000 cases a day, Dan Patrick, who is the lieutenant governor of Texas, kind of the leader of the furthest right flank of the Republican coalition in the state, immediately went on Fox News and says, we have to stop listening to Dr. Fauci. And, you know, essentially, what's unfolded in all of these states to varying degrees, but pretty severe degrees in all of them, is you have Republican governors in Florida, Georgia, Texas, and Arizona, who are primarily respondent to non-urban constituencies. That's the heart of the Republican coalition now in all of these states. And in each state, they opened early and widely. They have refused to reconsider as the caseloads have spiked. And most, I think, importantly, they have specifically preempted the Democratic mayors who resisted this this reopening from imposing tighter restrictions or rolling back. Ducey in Arizona and Abbott in Texas and DeSantis in Florida have been forced to back down one step and allow local governments to require masks, you know, which I know you've discussed as well, but they have not allowed them in any way to regulate the pace or reconsider the pace of the reopening. And so you have a very clear dynamic in all of these states where you have urban and suburban voters who are living through this very frightening spike in cases, operating in a situation in which explicitly their state Republican leaders are telling them they cannot do anything further to defend themselves, even if they want to. And I think that's, you know, obviously that carries a risk of intensifying and accelerating the movement of these suburban metros that we have seen. You know, I have said that if I had to pick one county in America that's going to pick the winner of the White House, it's Maricopa County in Arizona. It's the county center on Phoenix. It was the largest county in America, Warren, that Trump won in 2016. Won it by 45,000 votes. Only one Republican in the last decade has won the state without winning Maricopa County. And that was a state superintendent of education race where the Republican lost the county by a handful of votes. In 2018, Maricopa, though it was the largest county in America Trump won, it went Democratic. Kyrsten Sinema carried it by 60,000 votes. And there is polling now consistently this year where both Biden and Mark Kelly, the Democratic Senate nominee, are ahead by double digits in Maricopa County. And that's the kind of movement we're talking about. Those polls were mostly taken before Maricopa County was overwhelmed to the point where they're talking about rationing hospital care, as you know, in the last couple of days. So I think there is a significant possibility that Maricopa County will tip against Trump. And if it does, I think there's almost no chance he will be president.
And yet there still is this resistance. Here's Dan Patrick, Lieutenant Governor of Texas. You mentioned him. Stop listening to Dr. Fauci when the senator from Florida said maybe we ought to have masks. He got an enormous backlash from that, and that continues. But is that becoming a minority view?
Well, I think, look, I mean, nationally, there's no question that's a minority view, right? I mean, the polling has been unwavering that roughly 2-1 Americans worry about reopening too fast rather than too slow. Part of the big story in the Sun Belt, a central part of the story of the Sun Belt over the last 25 years, is that the college-educated white voters in the big Sun Belt suburbs are more conservative than they are in New Jersey or California or Denver. Fewer of them are open to Democrats, in part because more of them are evangelical Christians and they, you know, they have a 4-1 Republican, but also because they're kind of just steeped in a more culturally conservative atmosphere. What Trump and these Republican governors are doing, however, on the virus, and for that matter on race, is pressing directly at two of the central issues that fray that bond between the white-collar suburbs and the Sun Belt and the Republican Party. You know, they are expressly flouting science. They are defying scientific experts. And, you know, if you're a white-collar person living in a nice house in Gwinnett County outside of Atlanta, you're in that house because of your mastery of some expertise in all likelihood. I mean, you're there because you're an architect or a lawyer or an MBA, and you've gotten all of the nice things in your life because you have, you know, leaving aside questions of privilege and racism, from your own perspective, you've gotten what you've gotten because you've mastered expertise. And Republicans are basically saying, we don't value expertise. And then the second thing, of course, that's happening at the same time is that Trump is turning toward more overtly racist and racially inflammatory appeals, you know, describing Black Lives Matter as a hate group, treason, sedition. And again, same thing. You know, those voters may like tax cuts. They may be even conservative on some of the social issues, but they are uneasy with overt racism. They are uneasy with defying science. And, you know, Trump is testing how far this can go, how far he can go and still maintain the traditional allegiance, the improvement that Republicans have had among white-collar suburbanites in the South relative to elsewhere in the country.
You said at the outset that one of the major things that's happening is the dominance of younger voters as opposed to the boomers. Do you think those voters will turn out? And do they have enough faith in the system to think that going to the polls is in fact the way to bring change?
I'd be surprised if they turn out at the levels that Democrats are hoping for, right? So this is the first election where voters born, as I put it, after 1981 equal voters born before 1964 as a share of eligible or potential voters. They won't equal them as a share of actual voters because the older voters are going to turn out at a much higher rate. This, however, will in all likelihood be the last time that voters born, baby boomers and older, people born before 1964 will outvote people born after 1981. Because after this year, the gap, the post-81s, the millennials and Generation Z are so much of a larger share of the eligible voter pool than the older voters that even if they don't vote at the same, you know, they don't equal their turnout, they will still outvote them in numbers. So this is kind of the last time that will happen. I think it is unlikely. I mean, Democrats have struggled to figure out how to accelerate the improvement in turnout among these younger voters. I don't think Biden is the one to pick that lock. If you look, you know, polling consistently shows that his own favorable, unfavorable ratings among younger voters are not great, even as they are terrible for Trump. I mean, it is possible that Biden will push back to the 60% that Obama reached in 2012 among younger voters, maybe even the 67% that Obama reached in 2008. There was a Pew poll yesterday that had him at that level. But I don't think he will get the full surge of turnout they are hoping for, though I think the fact that the Floyd protests have erupted and engaged so many people means he'll probably get more than he would have on his own a few weeks ago. Of course, for Biden, this is less critical than it would be for Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, because one of Biden's conspicuous strengths relative to other Democrats is that he's running better among white seniors than any Democratic nominee since Al Gore in 2000.
How important is it that Biden pick an African-American woman to be on the ticket with him?
I kind of would be shocked if he didn't. I mean, you know, both in terms of how he won the nomination and also in terms of what's happening this spring. I mean, it would look like deliberate not to if you didn't at this point. And, you know, I don't think he wants to send that signal.
James Carville, famous, of course, since the first Clinton administration as a Democratic, outspoken Democratic strategist, is saying it's all over, that Democrats ought to forget the idea that they might actually lose to Trump and begin focusing on the Senate and so on. Do you agree with him?
Well, I did a podcast last week that James and Al Hunt host. And aside from the weirdness of, you know, answering questions of people I'm used to asking questions of, James said in that he thought we were headed for 55-42 in the election. That's what he thought the final would be. And, you know, on the one hand, you could say pretty consistently, Warren, 55% of the country has not wanted Donald Trump to be president. I mean, you know, he got 46% of the vote in 2016. Republicans got 45% of the vote in 2018. His approval rating has rarely exceeded 45% on any sustained basis. And the question has always been, how much of that 55% could Democrats consolidate? You know, I certainly wouldn't say that the election is over, both for a variety of reasons. One, because you know, Biden has never shown himself to be a great presidential candidate. That's true all the way back to 1988. I covered that campaign. You know, it's entirely possible for him to say and do things that will raise doubts among voters, including the debates, you know, being important. Second, Trump has an enormous amount of money, although money is overrated in presidential politics since people are saturated with news every day. And third, because there is a pathway available to Trump that's always been there, which is not winning the popular vote. I think Carville's right. There's essentially no chance anymore, not that there was ever much of one, but there's essentially no chance of Trump winning the popular vote. But if he can recover from his 41, 42, 43 to something closer to 46, there's a scenario where he can squeeze out the Electoral College. And that scenario is Biden wins all the 20 states that Clinton won. He adds Michigan and Pennsylvania, all of which I think are very likely. But then, you know, the next piece, you need one more piece if you win those 22 states. And the next piece is either Arizona, Wisconsin, or Florida. And none of those are simple. So if you know, right now there is no Electoral College strategy for Trump. When you're at 42 or 43 or even lower in some of these polls, you're going to lose all or almost all of the battleground states. But if he recovers and then if he raises the waterline, you know, 3 points, 4 points, maybe, not simple, not simple at all. But if he did, you could imagine a scenario where he can squeeze out the Electoral College. So I think it would be premature to say that he can't win. I will say that I do think there's only one pathway for him to win, which is that I think it is highly likely, for all the reasons we're talking about, not only the impact of the coronavirus being most damaging in the big metro areas, but also the outrage over George Floyd being most concentrated there. I think Trump's going to lose the big communities in America by even more than he did last time. He lost the 100 largest counties in America last time by a combined 15 million votes. I think he's going to lose them by even more, maybe a lot more, maybe 18 or 19 million votes. And as a result, the only real pathway for him to win is to turn out even more than he did in 2016 of his non-urban, non-college, evangelical, et cetera, base. And that's why I think you see him abandoning almost any kind of messages aimed at persuasion. He is just drawing a line in the electorate, largely around race, and trying to turn out more people who share or respond to his portrayal of the changing America as a threat to their status and their livelihood and so forth.
Okay, as always, you have given us a lot of things to look for, both between now and November and in November itself, and of course, beyond when it comes to the dominance of one party or the other. Ron Brownstein with The Atlantic and CNN, as always, many thanks.
Thanks, Warren.
The producer of To the Point is Andrea Brody. Our engineer is Chuck Prebatary. Other episodes are available on your favorite podcasting app. Now, if you want to reach us directly, we are at tothepoint_KCRW. You can reach me directly at WarrenAlney1. If you want to learn more about our guests and what we've talked about on our show, please visit our webpage. You can go to kcrw.com/shows, scroll down to the Point. You'll find links and details for all of our programs in our show notes. We've been talking about resistance to wearing a mask. Don't be part of a problem. All it does is fog up your glasses. That's not a big deal. So be sure to do it. Thanks for being with us this time. Join us again.